Hi, I'm Dr. Howard Rankin, and welcome to The Miracle Within You, the show at the intersection of psychology, medicine, and spirituality that considers how the mind and body interact with each other to influence health and healing. With years of experience as a practicing psychologist in the health and wellness fields, and as a writer covering amazing stories of healing, I will explore with my guests how numerous factors influence our lives and our health. Thank you for listening. Welcome to this edition of The Miracle Within You. And today I'm absolutely delighted to have with us two great friends, great scientists, great human beings, Dean and Aisha Sherzai, a practicing neurologist, scientist, authors, parents of two amazing kids, a husband and wife duo that know the value of healthy lifestyle choices. Interestingly, both of them had family members who had dementia, and that was an early commonality between the two of them. And they have continued to contribute enormously to this field. Tremendous academic record, professors at Georgetown, Columbia, National Institute of Health, Mount Sinai, Loma Linda, UCLA. We could just go on and on. Let's not hear me talking about them. Let's get them on the show. Dean, Aisha, it is absolutely delightful to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having us, Howard. It's always a pleasure speaking with you, and we're so delighted to be here.
Absolutely.
Great. So the theme of this show is really focusing on the things that people don't expect in terms of amazing things, or what we might call miracles. Amazing things that happen, the amazing chemistry we have inside of us that perhaps we're only still beginning to understand, and most people don't have a clue about it, that amazing complexity. And of course, the brain is the center of that, right?
Correct. Yeah. The brain is a remarkable organ. It's it has incredible capacity to process information, despite what we're hearing on the news on a daily basis with AI and all these large data models and all these amazing discoveries. It's nowhere close to what the brain can do in a small volume of space. 3 pounds, 2% of our body's volume, and it consumes 25% of body's energy, but it is so efficient. It can calculate better than any computer at this point. We think that no, computers can calculate better than humans, of course. No, but we're talking about the way it actually does it is incredibly efficient. And as far as creativity, they haven't figured that out yet. I mean, that's the whole holy grail, that they're trying to figure out how to create creative machines. And the human brain is doing that naturally. So it's just a remarkable, remarkable organ.
Yeah, and absolutely. And, you know, part of my work with Intuality, looking at how do you combine human and artificial intelligence, really shows the limitations of artificial intelligence. I mean, human intelligence is mind-boggling in terms of how the body and the brain use sensory impression, logic, personal experience to actually perceive and interpret things. And I like what a former person in this field way back in the 1960s, Dreyfus said, computers need bodies in order to be intelligent, that you need to have all that sensory information being processed and interpreted. It's just incredible, just incredible.
Absolutely. I mean, the children, when they're playing, they're literally data, you know, capturing data and processing it. That's the whole point. One of the main points is data acquisition. And the best thing, closest thing to that we have is The Tesla cars, ironically, the idea is that the Tesla cars are AI sensory devices that have c collected data for more than a decade now. But it's singular data, it's visual data, not even sensory to a great extent. And even then, after all this data collection, it's the best data source we have. Most people think it's going to be Google or others. No, you're absolutely right. We need sensory, contextual, changing data that can give us ability to look at information in context and change models. And that's the best we have. Whereas a child, after 3, 4, 5 years of life, gets more information and collects it in a more systematic way than all of those systems, plus the Apple and all these other companies combined. So it gives you an idea of the level of the scale.
Yeah, and then we hear about neural nets and oh, they've got all these amazing connections. Nothing
Nothing.
like what is going on in the body, right, Aisha? I
Yes.
mean, trillions of cells in constant communication.
It is, it is. And I think we've realized that trying to replicate even a part of the brain, has been a failure because human beings don't really have the perception or the lens to look at the brain the way the brain looks at the world. And so even the systems that we have built around interpreting how the brain works is essentially it doesn't replicate what actually goes on in the brain. And so I'm excited, especially being a physician and being involved with, unfortunately, the disease side of the things. And now we're moving more towards the prevention side of things, with the detection part getting better and the early identification part getting better, and scientists, sitting back and repurposing their tools and understanding the brain better. I'm hopeful, but you're absolutely right. We're not even close to scratching the surface as of yet.
And my vision of the future of medicine, probably quite a way into the future, is being able to access individual cells or clusters of cells and manipulating their messages to send, this is what you've got to send to here and why you've got to do it and when you've got to do it. Because that's sort of what's happening. We've got to understand that if we could control it, that would be amazing. Now
Definitely.
we talk about both of you, as you said, had family members with dementia.
Yes, and I think that has deeply shaped our work. You know the stories very well. We've spoken together about this. But having the privilege of taking care of elders in the family who were incredible human beings, and you see the devastation that neurodegenerative diseases cause to a person. And now being a neurologist and a scientist, I know very well about the pathological changes that goes on in the brain. But as a child and as an adolescent, seeing a phenomenally strong human being slowly and gradually lose parts of themselves and come to a point where not only do they not recognize you, but they don't recognize parts of themselves and how they relate to the world. That was profound, and that really left a lasting impression on us. I'm speaking for Dean here as well,
Absolutely.
and shaped our choices moving forward. And I know that we are in this field. We went into this field to find treatment for it, and during that journey, we found so much more.
Yes, and well, of course you have, and then you opened up the whole possibility of, well, what can you do to prevent and delay the onset of this condition? And you are the leaders in the field of, here are the things you can do. Don't wait till you're, 82 or what have you. There are things you can do now that will somewhat protect you as best as you can, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
I think one of the remarkable discoveries of our times about neurodegenerative diseases as a total, but specifically Alzheimer's disease, was that we shouldn't see this disease as a singular point in one's journey. And I think a lot of the technological advances in the field of neuroscience actually helped quite a bit to see these diseases as part of a spectrum of health, that most of the changes actually start very, very early. And that's important to know and apply, because unfortunately, we don't have any treatment for this disease and people are suffering. But if we understand that the changes occur very early, there's a lot that one can do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could you add to that, Dean? I mean, obviously, we could spend, you know, days talking about this, but, you know, the core.
Yeah, as Aisha stated, I mean, we started with this with from a personal perspective, almost like a selfish perspective, because we saw the suffering, we saw these amazing human beings lose parts of themselves to this disease. But in that journey, we found so much more. What we found was the humanity that was beyond the small parts, the humanity that was more than just memories. Memories are great and important, but there's something underneath that connects all of it. It's that island, that core island that makes us who we are. And at the end of the day, it's that thing that's of most value in this earthly existence, and it's critical for us to recognize that thing, and it puts everything into perspective. Because if it's not that humanity, that sense of me and me against the world, not against so much in separation of the world, then the valuation becomes difficult. It's because of how much memory does a person have to be human? How much cognitive capacity does a human have to be human of value? And how much ability to process visual information do we have to become? It's way more than those elements at their peak or at their it's the core sense of self, and that what makes us humans. It's interesting. We talk about AI and computers, and I always say, at the end of the day, we have no problem disconnecting a billion-dollar supercomputer, but we would have difficulty disconnecting a person that's conscious and at the core, all that's left is self-awareness and not much memory and everything else. Why? Because it's that core that matters. That core of self. Selfhood, humanhood. There's a meaning to that. There's a value to that. There's a value that actually we're all struggling to maintain and enhance. That's the journey that we found is of most value. That's the value that we found in our patients who are in late stage Alzheimer's that have forgotten their partner, but you see them suffer, but also you see them in moments of incredible joy where all of a sudden a song from their past is played and you see them cry. No supercomputer does that. And that's valuable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I remember that with my mother-in-law, who lived to be 90, almost 98. We visited her every day. And we used to play music from her era, you know, and suddenly she'd start tapping her feet and mouthing the words, you know, and, you know, it was different in how you can access and activate that brain is amazing to bring out parts of that experience that they've had. It's really, really mind-blowing, really, actually. Yeah. And you don't know. What they're going to remember, recall, associate, see, any of it, or even do that. You know, I was reading this morning about what that condition called aphantasia, where people have difficulty or can't actually visualize past events. And wow, that was interesting that they can talk about them and describe them, but they have no visual imagery because of brain structure. Of it, just amazing. The brain's complexity.
It is.
Definitely it is.
Yeah, and to speak to that, our ability to also all of a sudden this part, I'll give from a pathologic perspective, a person that can't remember much, now they're in late stage of Alzheimer's. All of a sudden, while you introduced, you seed a thought. All of a sudden, it's almost like those movies where you go through a tunnel and then you open up into a fantasy world and into this valley with flowers and animals, flying animals. So it's almost like that. All of a sudden, you've opened up a chasm, a world that wasn't available a second ago. And that world is rich. That world is full of content. That world is full of emotion. That world is full of concepts and memories and interactions. But that wasn't available just a second ago. In fact, not much was available. And that world is as rich as anybody else's experience that's 70 years old. That momentary experience is as rich as anybody else's experience. And it pull, you know, makes you take a step back and think about how we value those experiences, those human experiences. Is it in a temporal state? Oh, I can remember 40 years back. Not really. I mean, it doesn't matter. Is it in its context to something else, to somebody else, to others? Or is it that experience in itself, in that little world of consciousness that all of a sudden became accessible? That kind of gives you a perspective of valuing experiences. And for us, what's important is it gives you a perspective on valuing dementia patients. I know this is a little digression, but it's not even about dementia patients, it's about humanity, but it's good to you pick that concept as a model. When a dementia patient is in the last stages of its disease, all of a sudden has this incredibly rich, by the way, in many ways more rich than the rest of us. That's why dementia patients actually suffer more, have more pain perception, because other distractors have abated, and now the core senses, be it real or imagined, like the way I just described, just the ones that just appear, are actually in many ways richer than yours and my experiences, because ours are diluted by peripheral experiences and distractions and noise, and theirs is not. So the most important thing that we've been talking about in the last few months and is that dementia patient in stage seven, which most people actually almost put them away to kind of say, oh, we're waiting. No, those experiences are as rich as yours. Please address them, experience with them, feel for them, not so much as sympathy, but empathize with them. And that's a critical factor. That's the thing that we've that has connected us the most.
Absolutely. Beautifully
Yeah.
stated.
We'll talk about distractions. We're going to have to take a short break, commercial break, but we're right back with more discussions with the amazing Dean Ehnesha-Shesay. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to The Miracle Within You. Today, I'm delighted to have with me Drs. Dean and Aisha Shezai talking about, hey, the one miracle we've all got inside us is our brains and how amazing they are. We have been talking about that, and we will talk more about neuroplasticity and the amazing ability of the brain to adapt. But we were talking about dementia, an area where the Shezais have contributed enormously. And we were just talking about how even somebody with advanced dementia can still have amazing experiences, meaningful moments. And it's very easy for us to say, oh, well, and just label it. That's it. Put them in a box. They can't remember anything, do anything, what have you. But that's not really the case. And you guys clearly don't do that.
No. I'm bringing it back to our own personal experience.
Yes.
knowing this, understanding this has given us access to our own experience and our own grandparents that went through this. So a much greater empathy and love. I consider love deep, deep understanding and empathic connection to the other. It doesn't have to be human. It could be, but that deep connection. And for me, it has connected me much, much more to my patients, to my, I call them my families, and my own family, my grandfather. And one example of that was this behemoth of a man who was the head of an education of an entire country, a brilliant poet, philosopher. At age 27, he led an entire revolution as far as education was concerned for women. Later in life, dementia had ravaged his brain, all his children around him in Virginia, and a hunting lodge of all the places. If you guys know us now, you sitting around him, and he's feeling nervous because whenever he spoke, everybody listened. All the children, all the grandchildren, all the nephews, nieces, everybody else. There would be gathering. And at this stage, he was feeling incredible nervousness because he was aware of his failings. And given that his prowess, his pride, or his connection to the world was his ability to communicate, he had started to lose some of those faculties. He felt very nervous. You could see him look away. You could see him find excuses not to be in the group. You could see him going to his room. You could see him distracting with some statements and pointing somebody else to take over. So all the things that at the time we didn't notice, I definitely didn't notice. I was very young. But in retrospect, I recognize all those manifestations of anxiety, well, fight or flight. In his case, most of it was flight. But then what would happen is one of the children knew how to ask certain questions. Maybe it was just accidental because he knew that when he asked these questions, it would just open up that doorway, almost like Narnia kind of a thing. It opened up the doorway into a different universe. Yeah. And would ask him something about politics. And all of a sudden you see him all of a sudden shift and talk about the past. And in some lucidity and clarity and eloquence and detail and color and emotion and names, and I'm like, oh my goodness. And with that came an incredible sense of pride, not in a selfish, meaningless pride, but in a way that of comfort, deep comfort and joy. And as people take care of these individuals, it should be our job not to put pressure on people, but just awareness.
Yeah.
It's never pressure, never guilt, none of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Awareness to search for those doorways.
Beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah. I think we're all very used to putting a value on a person on how they function in this world. It's very function-based. If you are able to solve a crossword puzzle, if you are able to figure out the horrifying remote control that controls five or six different, you know, devices in your household, you are valued. And I think there is that is such a flawed and an unfair way of valuing a person who has had such experiences in his life. We're more than our memories. We are our stories are richer than us being able to remember what we ate for dinner last night. And I completely agree with you. I think having spent enough time with these lovely patients and our family members going through dementia, you notice that there's so much more. And I think, like you said, it's our job to make sure that we bring that to the surface.
Absolutely.
Yes, and we live in a culture which just emphasizes and focuses on doing things, not being. And there is a distinction between doing and being. Yeah, a bit of an overlap, but there's definitely a distinction. And, you know, we live in this culture, unless you're doing things, you know, you're not functioning well. And I think that leads to a lot of people not knowing how to, for example, relax, you know, properly. They don't know how to do that. Unless I'm working away, I don't know what to do. They don't know how to do it. It's a waste of time. It isn't, as you know. So, and that's where AI comes in. AI is a doing intelligence. Give it something that can be broken down into six steps, easy, functional, you can do it. Let's do it. Human beings are beings, not just doings.
Yeah. I hope that the optimal evolution of this product is that it does things for us. Mm-hmm. It does things that opens up space for us to be people that we need to be in the moment. Those experiences are infinite. Those experiences are bewildering gifts. They don't have a value in contrast to others' experiences. Whatever that experience is, irrespective of the overlay of information, the depth of information, that experience that's yours is as important, as rich, as meaningful, as infinite as anybody else's. And that's and hopefully, as it is, much of our time is spent doing and doesn't leave much time for being. I had started playing guitar during medical school, and on top of that, flamenco guitar. And on top of that, for somebody who hadn't done much music as a young person, and that's the wrong three elements together. And it was just frustrating. And of course, I would give up in 5 years and then come back to it. And now I have a little time where I'm sitting and I'm playing three or four chords, simplified my goals, and coming up with a tune that all of a sudden, I'm like, oh my God, that had resonance. That I recognize that song, and
I love seeing the joy on your face when that happens, that moment.
For, you know, people say, Dean, you have more degrees than a thermostat. None of it means anything in contrast to that moment of experience, of that doorway opening up to that experience. It's just remarkable. And hopefully these machines will give us time to experience those moments of epiphany. those moments of epiphany that, at least for the foreseeable future, is not available to these machines. And even if it is, it has to be programmed in. Beyond that, I can't say, to be honest. I become biased, self aggrandizer. But as it is, I think that's the unique thing that makes us human. And we found that through our journey in Alzheimer's, of all situations. And not just Alzheimer's. You were talking about a syndrome, stroke syndromes. Mm. Aisha, your experience, you're a stroke specialist, and she comes with these back from a hospital with these incredible cases.
Oh, they're fascinating. And not only does it, you know, highlight the magnificence of the brain, but It truly highlights the potential that we have of being the better versions of ourselves. It's quite natural for us to feel sorry for ourselves when we lose a, you know, function of part of the brain, but Over time, I think it has really taught us as neurologists and as scientists, you know, as people who actually see that happen, how, you know, people actually lose or sometimes even gain function when they have when a part of the brain essentially quiets down. You know, one of the recent cases that I was talking to Dean about, we discuss some cases because we and then we read about it together. Yes, you know, that's what neurologist couples do in their free time. They talk
Yes.
about neurology.
Yeah.
But
The good news is usually on the beach while we're walking.
Oh,
Yes,
that's good.
exactly.
Okay.
you know, this wonderful lady, you know, coming from a very traumatic background. She had a lot of vascular risk factors, and she was smoking, and you know, didn't really take care of herself. When you live with that trauma and when you live with those kind of stresses, it's very natural for you to stop caring for yourself. And unfortunately, she kind of fell into that loop. And so she had a stroke, which essentially, you know, for the audience who's listening, a stroke happens when a part, you know, an artery that goes into the brain gets blocked. It either gets blocked or it bursts open. And so there is compromise to blood flow to a part of the brain. And it could be any part of the brain. And the manifestation of the stroke depends on what part of the brain has been hurt. And in her situation, the part of the brain that was hurt was the control part. So it was the frontal lobe. And thankfully, it wasn't a massive stroke. It was a smaller stroke. But this stroke caused some inhibition in her. And so she actually had diminishing of her inhibitions. And she started having very artistic capacities. And, you know, for someone who was going through a hard time in life, suddenly she had this urge to start painting, and she became a very, very good painter. And she started painting different pictures of her own brain. She would actually take a picture of her MRI scan in the clinic, and then she would go and make
My
a beautiful
gosh.
picture about it. And during the next visit, she would bring that to me. And I have her paintings in my wall. And she started painting her husband's face with such intricate details. She even had the scar of her, you know, her husband had skin cancer on, you know, on the right side of her of his temple. And she spent such a long time
Amazing.
intricately describing that. So you see that, and then you wonder, you know, what capacities do we have that we are inhibiting because of life, because of the things that we were taught as a child? And it's just fascinating.
Yeah, and yes, and that's part of the basis of the show, because I've run into numerous people who actually were given fatal, prognoses. And all of them not only survived but thrived, doing different things. They had different conditions, but the one thing in common they had is, no, I'm not going to do it. They took that energy, and I think that is really important. And I think you guys obviously know about that, and that's what you practice in communicating to your patients. You're real people. You're not just another case, right? You're real people. And so much of medicine, for a variety of reasons, is oh well, just either take these pills or go away and do these things. And there's a difference between an idea, and there's a difference between doing an idea just because somebody told you, or doing something because it has meaning for you and you are fully engaged in it. And I do think that that is important.
Oh, absolutely,
Definitely.
infinitely. It's a world of difference. When you're invested in it, it's a completely different place in the mind. It's a completely different place in the mind as and in connection to yourself and to everyone else. It's that deeper connection. So that's what we strive for in our case with our patients, to reach that connection. We are kind of fortunate. We see patients in a situation where we have time. We are not we're not bound by the 10-minute patient call. So we get deeper into the conversations. We get deeper into the relationship. But at the same time, we make sure that we are aware of the nuances, the intricacies, because that at the end of the day, it's that's what's valuable.
Yep, absolutely. When we come back after the short commercial break, we'll talk about some of the preventive lifestyle measures that you have developed and offer for people to delay the onset of this condition. So we will be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the Miracle Within You. Today, I am absolutely thrilled to have with me Drs. Dean and Ayesha Shirzai. We've been talking about the brain, we've been talking about dementia, we've been talking about a lot of things. What I want to focus on in this last segment is the things that they have identified as critical lifestyle behaviors that any of us can adapt that will prolong our cognitive function and our brain life. Perhaps, Aisha, you'd like to start with nutrition.
Yes, absolutely. So lifestyle is very important, as we said. You know, the things that we do, the habits that we choose, the environments that we create for ourselves, whether they're external or internal, matter, because they literally either build your brain cells or they harm your brain cells. And so, making sure that we make the correct choices throughout our life is incredibly important. Nutrition is one of the most important factors because it induces either a stressful internal environment or one that helps our brain cells and the rest of our body thrive. We always say when you take care of the brain, you've taken care of the rest of the body. There was a time when the brain was considered separate from the rest of the body, but it's not. It's an organ. It has the same kind of arteries. It has the same kind of physiology. And so taking care of it really helps the rest of the body as well. As far as nutrition goes, there was a time when scientists would focus on specific types of foods, you know, like blueberries and walnuts, but now we're focusing on dietary patterns because we don't eat one food at a time. It's the synergy between these food products and these nutrients that matter. Several different dietary patterns have been studied. I'm pretty sure that the audience have heard about the Mediterranean and the Mind diet. And the reason is that has been validated in multiple different communities. And, you know, when we talk about the Mediterranean or the Mind diet, people think that it's a cultural dietary pattern, but it's not. It's essentially a dietary score. And I had the privilege of working with my professors and my colleagues at Columbia University who actually devised these scoring systems. And when you look at it, it's an algorithm. When you eat more of the good foods, you score higher. And when you eat foods that may be detrimental, you score lower. What are the foods that you score high on? Fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes like beans, lentils, and soy products, nuts and seeds. And the things that harm our brain health are essentially refined carbohydrates in the form of processed sugars, too much salt, too much saturated fats. These are the ones that actually start harming us. So a healthy dietary pattern looks like, you know, mostly the Mediterranean diet, which has lots of fruits and vegetables, lots of whole grains and beans, and good fats in the form of extra virgin olive oil, nuts and seeds, and reduction of foods like meats and high fat dairy products and things of that nature. And, you know, it's such an important element because, you know, we do this three, sometimes two or sometimes three times a day, and it literally builds the environment for the brain cells to do its job. And multiple studies have shown that when people adhere to this kind of a dietary pattern, they're able to lower their risk of Alzheimer's disease by 53%, which is amazing. I mean, just imagine a medicine that does that in the market. Everybody would be running and buying that pill. Mm-hmm. So you know, it was such an important element of our message that I actually went to cooking school and I started learning how to cook. And I found myself giving my patients more recipes than sometimes talking about their knee-jerk reflexes and their neurological exam, which is important too. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the kind of dietary pattern that we talk about, and we help our communities understand it. And also making sure that they learn how to cook for themselves and how to choose foods for themselves and for their brain health.
Yeah. And of course, this is all within the frame of what we've described as the Neuro Plan, self-serving acronym, Neuro, N-E-U-R-O, nutrition, exercise, unwind or stress management. R is restorative sleep, and O is optimizing mental and social activities. And if you do those things, you will significantly reduce your risk of dementia, but more importantly, maintain cognitive prowess as long as you can. We're talking about nutrition alone, and studies that we were looking at, these are suboptimal diets, because that's the data that we have when you're looking at populations. It was 53% reduction of dementia. Imagine that. Imagine if you had a more optimal diet. Now, the second element in that is E, which is exercise. We know exercise is important. Exercise is critical, but it's actually more important for the brain than any other organ, because the brain is the hungriest organ. It consumes 25% of body's energy, yet it's encased in a small structure, basically 2% of body's weight. So imagine the amount of energy, amount of blood, amount of immune response, amount of cleansing, amount of clearing, amount of CSF movement. All of this has to be done. In fact, the reason you sleep when we get to the R section is because the brain needs all that work and then restoration. And exercise is one of the best tools to do that, because it circulates blood. It pumps the blood to the brain efficiently. It increases these chemicals called BDNF and GDNF and VGF, which increase neuronal connections, neurons themselves, glial cells, which are these cleaning agents. They're more complex than that, but let's just call them that. And VGF, which increase vascularity. All of that is done by exercise. So we had a podcast in our podcast, Your Brain On. This last week was on cardio, and we had some of the most brilliant people in the world, basically, yes. The scientists that did the work on this topic. And what comes out over and over again is you have to do a little more aerobic exercise than you thought, you know, about 150 minutes to 300 minutes a week. And it doesn't have to be running or marathons or, you know, triathlon, none of that. A brisk walk. Our favorite thing is a brisk walk in the morning, or if you have a limitation of space, time, and equipment, while watching a show, half an hour show, stand up and do steps in place. That's it. That's amazing. And then the other thing is strength training, especially legs. They are your biggest muscles. They're the biggest sources of metabolic equilibrium. They are the ones that actually push the brain to create BDNF, this growth hormone. So those are critical factors for maintaining brain health and actually grows connectivity, whereas nutrition and stress management and sleep create the environment for brain to grow or decay if it's the other side. Exercise and optimize, special exercise, grows the connections. So to be honest, you got to exercise
That's
at
true.
any that you got to create a
There's no
pattern.
way around
No way around it.
it.
It could, if you have certain limitations, we understand, but the body is a closed system. If you can't walk, you can use one of those hand machines and but exercise.
Yeah, and the good news is, you know, for individuals who may have some disability, exercising any part of the brain benefits the sorry, any exercising any part of the body benefits the brain. So, and I think that's good news. So we don't have to run, we don't have to walk, and even if, you know, they're confined to a wheelchair, say for example, you know, exercising upper body is as good.
And here's a number. I should give a number, so I have to give a number for my
It's a competition.
competition. Yes.
Who has the
So
higher number,
yeah,
huh?
no, you win the higher number. That's the you got the higher 53. But
Okay.
a brisk walk, a recent study, well, long term, not recent, a long term study showed that a brisk walk, operative term is brisk, meandering is meditation. A brisk walk, 25 minutes a day. Especially if it's in the morning, although this study didn't focus in the morning, but we say morning because it resets your sleep cycle and everything as well. 25 minutes, reduce your chance of Alzheimer's by 45%.
Wow.
It's just remarkable. I mean, so brisk walk, that's critical. Let's just do, sorry, by 40%. So it's critical to get involved in exercise as soon as possible.
Yeah.
I'll do unwind, then you can do restore. So
Sure.
unwind is about stress management. Stress management is critical because it's the central tenet in our program, and there's a reason, because you couldn't spell neuro unless you had a U in the middle. But so I can, but the other way to look at it is central, because if you can't manage your stress, you're not gonna eat healthy, you're not gonna exercise, you're not going to sleep well. I mean, what's one of the main reasons for not sleeping well? Insomnia and running thoughts. So stress management. So we divide stress into two parts: good stress, bad stress. And it's important for you to do that. Get a piece of paper, write down specifically and measurably the bad stressors in your life. You know, I don't like this part of my job, but specific part. I don't like this part of my life, but specifically. And then I like this, and I want to do more of this, and I want to do this ultimately, but specifically, like me playing guitar, me wanting to run the marathon, me wanting to learn how to dance, although that might be an impossibility, a show in itself, but let's say dancing.
Don't give up. Don't
No.
give up.
But so, and then for bad stress, which is defined by activities, behaviors, and thoughts that are not driven by your purpose, that don't have clear direction and clear victories, reduce them, eliminate them, delegate them, or relabel them as this is necessary, I can't do without it, but they serve a higher another purpose. So, and do that actively in a written form and go over them so that you have a control over how it's this is going to evolve. Good stressors, empower them, tool them, educate yourself toward them, work systematically to increase that part of your life. And if you don't do that, the limbic hypothalamic pituitary axis will destroy you. That sounds like a movie. The like a Star Wars. But the emotional brain actually has direct effect on the pituitary through hypothalamus, which then affects all your hormones. And you can imagine what that means. So start managing your stressors systematically, measurably in a written form, and that's the key.
And I'm getting a little stressed out because we have like 4 minutes left, and I want you to be able to talk about your programs. So, Aisha, perhaps you can just talk briefly about sleep and social optimization and cognitive.
Sleep is incredibly important. Two very important things happen when we sleep: memory consolidation and cleansing. You know, everybody's running to this spa and that spa for cleanses. Sleep is the best cleanse. It literally gets rid of the byproducts in our brain every night. And when people sleep better, they have better memory, they have better recall, and they have better brain function. And as far as optimize is concerned, that's the good stress that Dean was talking about. It's pushing yourself to build those connections between your brain cells. And when people have complex and challenging lives that are connected to their purpose, a purposeful living, they tend to even be resilient when they have the presence of pathological changes of Alzheimer's disease, which is a fantastic news.
And you can, if those that want to see how we do this, actually NeuroAcademy is where we have communities, several thousand people, where they go through these programs. In fact, we have a 27-week cognitive optimization program. We have a neuro program, all of that in one environment, with plus moderators and all these community members that help out. With tools, resources, FAQs, all kinds of stuff that, and we've seen incredible changes in people.
And where can people find that? Is that braindocs.com?
So our website is thebraindocs.com, and they will find the resources on that page. The community that Dean was speaking about is NeuroAcademy, which is found on that website, but they, you know, people can actually look into neuroacademy.com as well for more information.
And we have a mastermind coming up on the 2nd of April, a 1-hour mastermind on help to improve memory. So for those that want to be involved in that.
And I presume that will be an ongoing thing.
Yes.
You'll have it at various points in time.
Yes, yeah. It's a webinar that's connected to the bigger program about cognitive optimization. Yes.
That's great. And I wrote a poem about the Shirzai some time ago. I'll just read the last two verses. And one last thing about the Shirzai is you'll not find more brilliant, authentic, wise guys. They're not doing it just to make a few bucks, but they know firsthand how dementia, it sucks. Give them a chance to help you upgrade your life. You'll not get more value from a husband and wife. Together, we can all make a massive improvement. So sign up today and join their great movement.
Oh, wow.
We love you, Howard.
We Thank love you so much.
Yeah, well, likewise, because you guys are incredible. By the way, they have two amazing children. We didn't have a chance to talk about Alex and Sophie, but perhaps we'll do that another time. But thank you, thank you, thank you so much for your time. I know how precious it is.
It's our
pleasure. That's very kind of you. Thank you for having us.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Miracle Within You. Join me next time when I continue to explore the power of the mind-body and how it can be employed to enhance health and healing.